It's Jessica Moran, and she will talk about the limits of forensic, which is an interesting couple with Christian, because the cryoflux controller is not only used for preservational purposes, but also for forensic purposes, because it's really is able to create identical image of the data which is stored on the data carrier. And we will hear now a presentation which she worked out with Jay Gattuso, her colleague, which unfortunately could be with us. And the title of her presentation is End-to-End Workflows for Collecting, Preserving, and Providing Access to Born Digital Collections and the Limits of Digital Forensics. And of course, I should not forget to introduce you. You are working as an archivist at the National Library of New Zealand, and you are especially bothered with unpublished born digital material there. So Jessica, please.
So I changed the title slightly from what was there, but it's the same idea. I just want to talk a little bit today from the perspective of a digital archivist who's working with these collections, and talk a little bit about digital forensics and born digital collections. I want to talk briefly about the impact of digital forensics has had on our thinking about working with born digital collections in the library, archives, and museum world. And then I want to talk a little about the National Library of New Zealand's current born digital ingest process, our digital preservation environment, look at our workflow and the decisions that we've made in two recent collections, and draw some conclusions about how we have and have not incorporated digital forensics into our own workflows. That's my overview. In 1994, Canadian archivist Elizabeth Diamond suggested that we see the archivist as a forensic scientist. She explained that the historian, when first encountering a document, will ask, "What is this about?" But for the archivist, the first question should be, "What is this?" As archivists, our central job is not to explain the documents are about or what content is held within them, but rather who created them, how they were created and used, and how they arrived in the archive. Our job is to explain a document or collection's provenance and original order, its content, context, and its chain of custody. Diamond argued that archivists, like forensic scientists, become expert witnesses and testify to the nature of documents. She argued that this actually becomes even more important with born digital collections, as the context of the records is not as immediately obvious to the user. The archivist as forensic scientist must translate the records and be able to testify that they have not been tampered with or falsified. In 2009, archival theorist Luciana Durante picked up Elizabeth Diamond's 1994 call, and she asked, if archivists should see themselves as forensic scientists, what exactly did that mean? Well, in the last few years, there has been a body of knowledge that's developed within the archival world for the digital archivists and how to work with born digital collections. And while this work's still young, one of the areas that's gained the most traction has been the field of digital forensics and way in which digital archivists can borrow from and incorporate digital forensics work into our own field and inform our own best practices. So the Digital Forensics Research Workshop defines digital forensics as the use of scientifically derived and proven methods towards the preservation, collection, validation, identification, analysis, interpretation, documentation, and presentation of digital evidence derived from digital sources for the purpose of facilitation or furthering the reconstruction of events found to be criminal. In her work, Luciana Durante identified two principles at the foundations of forensics practice that are consistent with the practice of the digital archivists, those of non-interference and identifiable interference. Borrowing tools and practice from digital forensics can help ensure that either non-interference in the records to the archives, or if that's not possible, then the well-documented and identifiable interference, either of which would help the archivist to testify to the authenticity of records under their care. For a number of years now, there's been suggestions that borrowing from the field of digital forensics can help us maintain our own principles when it comes to born digital content. Those theoretical principles for the non-archivists in the room include the preservation of the document's original order, its provenance, and that documented chain of custody of where the records have come from and how they ended up in the archive. Archivists have found inspiration from the world of digital forensics because it's a mature field with best practices, guides, and tools that seeks, though for different reasons, to do much the same thing as archivists have been trying to do. That is to acquire evidence without altering or damaging the original, establish and demonstrate the examined evidence is the same as that which was originally obtained, and analyze that evidence in an accountable and repeatable fashion. As archivists, we seek to acquire and transfer evidence of the documentary record of our institutions without altering or damaging the original. We want to establish and demonstrate that the records are the same as when we receive them, and we want to analyze and report on anything we do in an audible and transparent manner. Some of the most notable projects to write about their experience with digital forensics and Bourne digital cultural heritage material include the Ames projects, which ran from 2009 to 2011 and was a multi-institution research project. A 2010 Council on Library and Information Resources paper. Work at the British Library, most recently with Jeremy John's paper on digital forensics and preservation. And the demonstration project of the processing of Salman Rushdie's papers, Bourne Digital Papers at Emory University, Stanford's Bourne Digital Processing Lab, and most recently the work of the Bit Curator Project at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where they're working to develop a suite of open source digital forensic tools specifically for archivists and others working with cultural heritage material. Many of these projects describe their work with digital forensic tools as starting with the creation of the forensic disk image. For example, the most recent Bit Curator white paper argues that disk image should be the cornerstone of forensic methods, and that the digital repository structures should be adapted to accommodate disk images as baseline digital objects. And as we just heard from Christian's talk, there's definitely a good argument that the disk image, it's the original, it's the bit stream, and you want to maintain that, keep that. But how have we at the National Library been incorporating digital forensics into our transfer and ingest process? First, we don't actually create disk images as the regular step in our ingest process, though we have incorporated other aspects of forensic workflow, such as our fixity policy and our documentation policies. However, to more fully understand some of the decisions that we've made over time, it might be helpful to have a little background. The National Library of New Zealand has been processing Bourne digital material as part of business as usual since the early 2000s, and since 2008 has been preserving that material in the National Digital Heritage Archive. That means that we really don't have that problem of disks on a shelf anymore. Everything that comes into our library gets taken off its physical media, and the files are put into the NDHA. The NDHA uses Rosetta, a digital preservation system that was developed in a partnership with the National Library of New Zealand and Ex Libris. And that means that following our appraisal and transfer of all of our Bourne digital content, our collections are ingested into the NDHA, where they'll be available, depending on access policies, either online, in our secure reading rooms, or by individual permission. And what you see in the slide above here is just a sort of like overview of how Rosetta works, our various ingest streams, the permanent repository, and how we deliver through our various collection management systems. So, to give you an idea of the size and diversity of our Bourne digital collection. Unpublished collections make up only 22% of all the intellectual entities in the NDHA. Other digital content being preserved includes Bourne digital published material coming into library through legal deposit, Bourne digital music, videos, digitized collection, and material from our web archiving program. Unpublished material is organized by curatorial area in the library, including, as you see here, manuscripts, photographs, cartoons, oral history, music, and ephemera. However, as you could see, the manuscript collection makes up about 75% of our Bourne digital content. So today I'm pretty much limiting my discussion to our manuscript collection. And that manuscript collection is growing continually and currently includes about 1.7 terabytes and over 200,000 intellectual entities. The library receives born digital content on a variety of physical media, and we don't refuse donations based on format. So we've received everything from 5 1/4 inch floppies, tape drives, to things, digital downloads like Dropbox and just emailed collections. To give you an idea of the numbers, so we've processed over 300 3.5 inch IBM floppies, 178 formatted Mac floppies, 335 CDs, 85 collections arriving via email. And what this is sort of one of the, some of the metadata when we put things into the NDHA is what the physical media that it came up in on, so I'm able to report on that from here. So that just gives you a sense of all the different kinds of physical media that have come in over the years. And this just to give you another sense of what a large proportion of floppies that have come in over time and what a small percentage of things like zip disks, USB flash drives, and digital downloads are. Once the files are transferred to the library, let's see, is that the one I wanted to show you? Yeah, this is sort of interesting that while floppies made up such a large percentage of the physical media, the number of files this represents is actually quite minuscule when compared to the number of files that come in on something like optical disk or things like digital downloads or email. So in reality, the floppies make up only about 1% of files that are coming into our collections. As you can see, the largest number come in through email or other non-media transfer. Usually this means we or the donor have transferred the files by copying them to an external drive. One of our own drives that will go somewhere and they will copy things and select what they want to send to us. Once the files are transferred to the library, they go through a number of steps as part of their ingest and appraisal by the digital archivist. These include assigning each media item a unique number in the collection management systems and in registers, attaching any media to the processing workstation through a write blocker, virus checking, and the creation and verification following copy of hashes and checksums, the creation of a file list, documenting original order, use of file format ID software, use of specialized hardware and software to read the files. If they include obsolete format, sometimes the creation of access copies, technical analysis of file formats, dealing with any file naming issues, often it's special characters and file names, missing or mismatched extensions, and then the creation of an ingest report to curatorial staff that documents our process. All of this is just to say that we do have established processes for all born digital material must go through when it enters the library. If the basic digital forensics capture workflow is identified as an audit trail, write protection, and forensic imaging with hash values created for the disk and the files, and at the end of the workflow, an audit culminates in a detailed report, then with the exception of forensic disk imaging, our process does follow this workflow. But based on current business policies of our descriptive preservation and access practices, potentially adding forensic disk images to our workflow does have serious implications at all levels. Would we treat the disk images as a preservation copy and describe and ingest it and then train users on how to read and access disk images? Would we preserve the disk images and then a second set of exported files from the disk image into the NDHA? Would we use a disk image just for appraisal and preserve only the exported files? These are questions we've asked ourselves and are grappling with, but as yet, we've been unable to come to a satisfactory decision. Two recent collections might help illustrate how these questions present themselves to us during our everyday work. One is the papers of a prominent New Zealand author and critic, and the other is the records of an arts organization. Both collections are hybrid, made up of both traditional analog material and born digital objects. In the case of the author and critic, the born digital content included 88 removable media items, 55 3.5 inch floppies, 35 CDs. Of those, only 6 floppies were unreadable. With these 6 unreadable disks, we did also try to make disk images using both Cryoflex and BitCurator in an attempt to retrieve some data off the disks. But we were largely unsuccessful at recovering anything from these disks. And it was actually, if you were here yesterday and you saw Denise's presentation on imaging floppies using Cryoflex, and she had the bad boot sectors, and that was basically the same thing that we were happening. So we were unsuccessful at going into the hash and trying to make them work to read them at all. These 88 media IDAs span the dates 1989 to 2007 and included over 1,900 files and almost 2 gigs of data. The ingest report documenting our process was roughly 70 pages, not including the appendix file lists and droid reports for each media item. The most common issues we found with files were files without extensions, mismatched extensions, special characters such as full stops and file names that are a problem in modern computer operating systems. And often the files were backups or copies of manuscripts in progress that we also had the analog copies of, and most floppies would maybe have one or two files on them. In contrast with the personal papers example is a more modern organizational papers. In the transfer of this collection, the staff made a number of visits to the donor prior to transfer. After discussions with the donor and an initial high-level survey of the file structure and content, the digital archivist left a 1 terabyte external hard drive with staff of the organization, and they spent a number of days copying files to the hard drive for transfer. When the external drive was returned to us, it included 194 gigabytes, accounting for roughly 94,000 files. During accessioning of the analog portion, the collection, an additional 100 optical disks were also identified. Because of the large size of the collection, as well as the diversity of naming conventions and file formats, and the limitations of our own hardware, completing our initial processing of this collection was neither fast nor smooth. There were a number of issues we ran into, especially when trying to establish fixity due to long paths, illegal characters and file names, and just not always having the right tools to copy files and create and verify hash values over such a large collection. The external hard drive used to transfer the files belonged to the library and had been used for a number of years to transfer collections to the library. So documenting or preserving a forensic disk image would mean creating a very large digital object that included unwritten to or deleted parts of the drive that had absolutely nothing to do with the original creator's content. We knew that what the donor had copied onto the files were the files they intended to transfer to the library. Preserving a disk image of anything more than that would not have made sense. In the case of the personal papers of a writer, perhaps disk images may have given us more details than we were able to capture just by copying files. However, while there's undoubtedly potential value in having the disk images during our pre-ingest process, where they act essentially as the baseline for content on the disk, but after that initial transfer of files to their physical media, how valuable would these disk images be to the user? Would 80-odd individual disk images, often with only 1 or 2 files, be useful to a researcher? Or would having those files organized and accessible by series in relation to their analog companions not be more useful? Certainly, these cases are different than that of an individual's computer hard drive or floppies for a game, where there's a lot of sort of internal components that need to work together. But as time passes and physical medias and methods of transferring files change, we need to be cognizant that more and more of our content will come through transfers from external drives or through transfer services like Dropbox, rather than a donor just giving us their laptop or computer. Borrowing practices and principles from the world of digital forensics has been useful for digital archivists. It's given us a well-documented set of practices and tools and a language, and especially as our own field has been trying to define what our own best practices are in the world of born digital. But we still need to continue, I think, to make a distinction between borrowing tools, workflows, and demonstrated best practices from the field of digital forensics without giving up our own theoretical underpinnings and best practices. As the quote on the slide explains, the use of digital forensics techniques and technologies in the context of archives and cultural heritage inevitably calls for broadening of the term. I think it's really helpful to remember that we're borrowing tools and practices from digital forensics to do our ingest work, not doing digital forensics ourselves. We should try not to conflate creating disk images with doing digital preservation. creating disk images is just one of the possible steps that the digital archivist and the digital preservationist need to go through when preserving a digital object. There are indeed many similarities in the way archivists and digital forensics treat digital objects. And while digital imaging has become and will continue to be one of the tools the digital archivist will use, I don't think it will or should become an absolute necessity to the process of born digital collections. Some collections don't need this level of processing. Some, such as those transferred via online mechanisms or via library hardware, it just won't make sense. And in some cases, it would also be an issue of sustainable growth and storage ability. Retaining a 1 terabyte disk image for 190 odd gigs of actual data takes up considerably more storage than the individual files. And retaining a disk image and a copy of individual files, while perhaps the best possible solution in some cases in terms of both access and preservation, will take up even more space. As our born digital collections grow, we will continue to have an obligation to provide adequate, secure, and safe storage for our collections, and may have to make decisions about how we store these collections. Just as we've always prioritized which collections are processed and to what level with traditional analog collections, so we have to continue to use the same critical judgment when it comes to our born digital collections. Perhaps if we see digital forensics not simply as that bitstream level of forensic copying of physical media, but as all the other parts of documenting and maintaining the authenticity of the record throughout the chain of custody and throughout its life cycle, that we can learn the most from the field. Disk imaging is not always the best solution to the problem of the diversity and difficulty of working with born digital content, but is instead one among many tools that the digital archivist will use to maintain the authenticity of digital collections under their care. So that's my, thank you.